When did you come into social work then?
I started my medical social work training in August 1935.
Yes. Had you come with previous experience of social work?
Not really, no. I came from a... my father was a doctor, my mother was a nurse. I'd been brought up in, you might say, a very much Christian socialist atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And so I think, in a way, I was very attuned to things.
Yes.
But quite frankly, until about 18 months before I came into training, I had no intention of being a social worker at all.
Really? Yes. Yes. How did you get to hear of it then?
Well, my father was much involved in it. He'd been on the council of the Institute of Medical Social Workers, well, it was called then the Institute of Almoners. And I went up to the university, determined I'd have nothing to do with science, because there was far too much science and medicine in the family, and really wanted to be an archaeologist, and I read a classical degree, mostly. And then, of course, one realizes, when you get up here, but it was only those days, first class honours, men, very lucky and probably with the private means, you got into archaeology.
Yes.
So I started looking around for a sort of another profession, because I knew I'd have to work. And a discussion with my father, I came up with social work.
Yes.
I always rather laugh about it now, because when it came to what kind of social work, he said, well, he thought medical social workers were the best dressed. So immediately to my, I could say, immature or undergraduate mind, that meant they must be slightly less dotty than the rest of the world, as it were. So I decided I'd, you know, try for medical social work. Mm-hmm. And I went into the event, the institute had a... It had two times. I mean, it had an 11-month training and a 16-months. And you did the 16 months if you had not got, if you hadn't done any family welfare, which was the old COS.
Yes. Yes.
You were supposed to have a SOCSI PG mm-hmm. diploma, but I changed subjects my last year at Oxford and had done economic history and theory. And I bamboozled my way through the committee. When I became a tutor many years later, I would never have let anybody do what I did. So, I came down from university in August. I started off mm-hmm. as a COS student in Hoban, the old Hoban City in Finsbury COS office.
Yes.
In a very, very hot August weather.
What was it like in that office? What sort of things did you do?
Well, we, of course, we sent on visits. It was kind of pattern of the day was that in the morning you did most of your telephoning and correspondence, and in the afternoon you set off visiting. With a list of visitors, list of places to visit, people to visit. Remember, I was scared stiff of my first ones. And of course, a lot of it was either, well, there were sort of preparing cases, material to go to the committee which decided on what COS would help, okay, would give. You might say now, in our terms, following up for decisions of the committee. And there was quite a bit of, quotes, almoning, unquotes, of pensions, mm-hmm. like baker's pensions, a good deal of money, of course, in the old city trusts and
yeah.
so on, city parochial foundation, and things like that. And there were these people who were very, a lot of them were administered through the old COS offices. So that you would go off and do that.
Yes.
There was a very well-known secretary of the office who was, you might say, your casework supervisor and boss and controller of everything, and somebody called Miss Bolton.
Miss Bolton?
Miss Bolton. I think she's probably dead by now. I just don't know, you know. And she was, I think she was an extremely able person.
Yes.
But to a woolly young, newly qualified graduate,
yes,
with an awful lot to learn, capable of writing a moderately good essay every week, but quite incapable of writing a business letter. It was quite an eye-opener, shall we put it. And she was pretty strict too. It was a very good training, really, because the kind of things which she was absolutely emphatic on is that you didn't say that the client had lost his job.
Yes.
You said the client says he's lost his job, and she was very, very, and this actually had appealed to me, I think, basically from with one's educational background, this intense accuracy, and I think, I hope I've kept it all through my professional life, really. This, it's so easy to say, really, to assume that what, you know, say this happened. Well, what you really, most of our evidence is purely circumstantial. It is what the patient says happens, isn't it?
Yes.
And she was very good about that. But you got an awful lot of your letters returned. And I have known them be flung across the office at you. But I don't think we minded it. You see, I think probably the modern student would be very offended at this. But I don't think, honestly, we minded somehow. We wrote those letters with some special kind of ink, which then the man, as a kind of man called the agent, who took them down to some mysterious room in the basement and had laid them on a jelly thing and rolled them like this, and a sort of yellow, rather blotchy ink copy came up, and the ink on your letter was then a little bit blurred. And that was your carbon.
Yes.
Incredible, really. I don't even know what the process was. And in that office, he always took up references. We always had to take up references from employers to verify wages. And he did all that because there was it was an area which covered a lot of the warehouses and city businesses and things like that, and I suppose he got, he knew his way in better, as it were. So that was how I began.
Did your supervisor sort of discuss things like methods of interviewing and things like that, or was it?
I think, as far as I could remember, it's so long ago now, only probably if you didn't bring the goods home, you might say. If you had visited somebody and rarely come back with a pleasant conversation about the weather and not got to what was the problem, she would then cross-question you and say, why didn't you and couldn't you have said so-and-so? But if you managed to get what was needed out of your interview, no, she didn't. I mean, I suppose, honestly, I can't remember, and I suppose the very first day I went out, I was told about knocking the door and introducing myself and so on. I've just frankly forgotten that. And, of course, there was a very high standards of confidentiality. There, and I, looking back, I think quite as high a standard, if not higher, than we've got of allowing the client self-determination. You know, we tend to think, I think, that this was the bad old days when social work was very kind of paternalistic. But in actual fact, there was a very great respect, I think, for people there, and that was acceptance. Well, if you don't want, you know, it was a sort of a contract in a way. If you don't want to meet COS's terms, which were A, your wages were verified, perhaps your rent was verified, and it went to a committee and they decided, you know, this, that and the other, And if you didn't want your help on that terms, well, you didn't have to have it. You were told the terms very clearly. And in that way, I think, I don't know what we've moved. In fact, perhaps we've gone through a phase of moving further back, really.
Yes. Well, presumably a lot of the people that you were visiting from the Hoban COS office were people who today would be covered by state unemployment insurance, National Health Service, things like that.
Well, there were quite a lot of referrals from hospital social workers, mm-hmm. and a large collection of clients where you had to provide artificial teeth. And so I suppose you'd say that was partly the health service, but in actual fact, health service doesn't cover artificial teeth now. So I'd be intrigued to know what happens, you know. Two very poor people, because frankly, one doesn't hear very much of it from the social services point of view.
Yes.
Well, practically everything, like from convalescence, artificial teeth, extra diet,
yes.
prostheses, and so on. You see, there was a certain amount of money from the friendly societies, because the more stably employed people paid their national health insurance through things like foresters and ancient order of buffaloes. And they had a varied collection of extra benefits.
Yes.
So it was quite a lot of that. There were these pensioner people. Quite a lot, I suppose, of poverty from sickness and possibly giving people short-term financial help. A very strong policy of, if it was a long-term financial help, of seeing that they got what they should get out of the poor law, because it was in those days, 1935, it was the old poor law days.
Yes.
I think COS wouldn't have taken on a poor law case. But I think they would have done a good deal towards chivying the poor law into doing justice to the client.
Acting as sort of advocate.
Really, basically acting as an advocate. We didn't go in for names like that.
No,
it was just a question. He doesn't seem to be getting what he ought to do. You know, get their permission to ring up X.
Yes.
So this was more what it was.
I was thinking what you said at the very beginning. You said that your family background was a Christian socialist, and I wondered whether when you had no idea about social work up to 18 months before joining, whether it was actually what you expected it to be, and how you related that to your own beliefs.
Difficult to say. Obviously, some of the ways people lived was a surprise. On the other hand, there were plenty of tales at home from my parents' experience, like my father saying when he did his midder in Leeds, on the district, sitting under an umbrella because of the thingamies that fell out of the wall and ceiling. So you weren't really, in a sense, that kind of poverty and poor conditions. You hadn't seen them with your own eyes, but you knew they existed. And you knew that chronic handicap existed from hospital experiences. I suppose, you knew unemployment existed because we'd heard a lot about we were Quakers, actually. We'd heard a lot about the Quaker allotment system for people in 1919, down in the mining areas. 1926 of that year's strike, so that I suppose you might say that theoretically it was quite familiar to me, and one was instantly sympathetic with it.
Yes.
The reality of it,
yes.
The actual people who wore the clothes, as it were,
yes.
were of course new.
Yes.
I think honestly, very quickly, one got to like them too.
Yes.
Even though I was a very shy person, and I'd been brought up in a bit of out of this world, you know, I hadn't been to the cinema much, and I hadn't been. I went to the university, and I'd been brought up very quietly. But honestly, I think one quite quickly liked them, and
yes.
one had a great appreciation of London in a way. And
yes. Were you not a Londoner then?
I hadn't been brought. We'd lived in London since 1930. That was all.
Yes,
I'd been brought up in Buckinghamshire.
I see. Yes.
No, but I think one sort of had perhaps you would call it an artistic appreciation of people's beauty,
mm.
and the beauty of the most unlikely circumstances.
Mm.
And the really very funny things when you knocked at a door, because there were these three tenement houses, and you were of course told not to ask for anybody because of neighbours. If you couldn't get an answer, you crept away. And in one case where I knocked, and after a bit, a voice at the top said, "If you're looking for Mrs. So-and-so, she's gone hopping." It took me a long time to discern what. Well, in actual fact, what it was, she had gone hopping, and of course, towards the end of August and September, there was an enormous exodus in those days
yes.
of people who went down to the Kent hop fields. You know, in actual fact, this was a rich experience in a way. I didn't go down to the hop fields, but very much feeling part of, you know, beginning to feel part of the sort of the pulse of life
yes.
Of a place.
Yes.
And but I was fascinated by it, frankly. I mean, I was a very poor social work student, I'm quite sure. And I never got any of the very difficult jobs to do, because I think I was probably considered quite incapable of doing so.
Yes. Did it impinge on, maybe I'm making an assumption, let me ask the question to see. Did it impinge on what you saw as the socialist solution to the problems you were confronted with? And was that confirmed for you, disconfirmed, or didn't impinge?
I don't think, honestly, probably it impinged. I say I was brought up in a kind of Christian socialist atmosphere. It was not a political political atmosphere.
Yes.
It was more Christian, perhaps, than socialist, you could say, which very brought one up to believe in the essential worth. I was brought up in a very classless sort of attitude to class, in a way. And I think this sort of affected one. I mean, one was, in a sense, horrified at poverty. I don't think I had any political solutions to it.
No.
I'm sure I didn't. I used to have some annoyance when we sat like mice round the edge of the committee room and listened
yes.
to these people pontificating on their decisions.
Yes.
And we used to get a bit, you know, oh my God, you know, being a bit superior, you know, and being very judgmental.
This is the COS.
COS, because all the cases went
yes.
to committee. And I certainly do remember feeling, you know, one's sympathies were always with the client,
yes.
frankly. I knew about Sorva, they should have been a bit more generous.
Mm.
On the other hand, I didn't have an inkling of the budget they were working on.
No.
And they only had, after all, they were supported by voluntary contributions.
Yes, yes, surely. I wondered whether you... Mm-hmm. Had any thoughts about the workings of the poor law, for example, and whether state provision should be altered in any way, whether there was any of that in the air at the time.
I wasn't, didn't meet it, mm-hmm. I think, personally. I suppose these were the days before one was, for sociology, you might say, entered into social work and discussion about social consciousness and class consciousness and so on. And one was much more concerned with sort of plain economic theory and history.
Yes, yes.
Well, no, and I think one was concerned about unemployment, but I don't know that I saw any political or economic solutions to it. Mm. I was going to say any more than one does now sometimes.
I was wondering whether... I'm not altogether clear about dates, but I believe somewhere at this time when the unemployed who were out of benefit were being receiving money from the PAC... There was some talk, I believe, about the government taking over responsibility for the uninsured or out of benefit unemployed, and there was I think it's a bit later on than it, but I think there was, people talked in terms of two appointed days, the first of which arrived before the war, this doesn't ring any bells for you, is it being...
there must have been some reorganisation of unemployment assistance. Because it was in the financial crash, wasn't it,
yes.
In the 30s,
yes.
That the government started raiding the funds for unemployment benefit, and then it was restructured on a more sort of economic basis.
Yes.
I think we always referred to it as unemployment assistance, so it had become off the PAC, hadn't it, then?
Yes, it was off the PAC. Yeah.
I think we used to write or UAB.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't think there was a great deal of unemployment relatively in London then. It was still, I suppose, pre-war, the era of small businesses and warehouses, and a lot of the Hove and City in Finsbury, a lot of it was that old-fashioned property behind by St. Bart's Hospital, down Soho, and then we went up towards Middleton Square, not in, to be almost touched Islington. There weren't, I think, people working in large factories. And therefore, I suppose the implications of unemployment were not so devastating. I mean, I think it is when you get a very large industry employing thousands of people like Cowley that recession rarely makes unemployment intolerable.
Yes.
I mean, it's intolerable in a way, but when it is 20 people in a firm and perhaps they have to drop one, it is just not so visible, and maybe because you do find yourself... find it easier to get back into the into employment.
It was, I suppose, in the 30s, it was mostly shipbuilding and coal mining, wasn't it, badly, where those areas...
Where those big, where those really the big things, the big employers were. But they were very much small. Small firms, I think, they were working for.
Yes.
Concerned with the sort of life of London.
While you were doing this placement at the COS then, and having been accepted by the Institute of Armaments, were you Did you have seminars at the Institute, or were the seminars?
No, we didn't have anything at all. In actual fact, we had to change placements after 2 months.
Yes.
And my second placement, I went. The Hoban office was quite a big one, and there were 4 or 5 students there.
Yes.
And certainly one of them is Hope Murray,
yes,
who became Deputy Chief Welfare Officer to DHSS,
yes,
you know. I mean, she was, and one of our famous students there, she wasn't, you know. But I went on then to Lambeth North,
yes,
which was a very small office,
yes,
run by somebody called Miss Barton, who was a very young,
yes,
COS secretary. I think possibly she may have had some supervision from the South, Miss Cope in South London. And I think I was the only student there, and of course it was a very different, one of the things you immediately felt was it was a different bit of London.
Yes.
It's difficult to explain, but the feel of it, and the feel of your clients was different.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, there was much less of the small, I suppose you say, working class respectability.
Yes.
And much more kind of costers,
yes,
people working in Lambeth Market.
Yes.
A very colourful environment.
Yes.
And,
yes,
and I loved it from that point of view. You know, it was really a delight to be sent down, even if you were going to the most grotty kind of place for a visit, because you could walk down Lambeth Marsh and,
yes,
and so, you know, and the, like that.
Yes.
I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Yes.
Say, just because it gave me, it was so much, so colourful.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the people were very, we say, were very different. I got different experiences. I mean, you know, when I was in Lambeth, when I was in Finsbury, I was sent off to interview some damsels who were in bed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, buxom wenches who I think were probably very busy in the evening, shall we put it. when I was at Lambeth, I had to go and see somebody who was in, was it called Carrington House? There was a man's common lodging house. Further down, there was a Carrington House in Deptford, I know, when I was an almoner. In any case, there was a common lodging house down there, and I had to prowl into that to see somebody, which was quite an eye-opener. I think always one was much less, I was certainly much less concerned with political solutions than compassion.
Yeah.
Here were people that needed help.
Yeah.
And rather than here were people who should be organized to rebel, to,
yes,
have a revolution.
Right. Yes.
And this, I suppose, was the attitude of which we were all brought up in much more in those days.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I mean, I was much prefer, I would have seen myself, I was doing anything different, like I rolling up my sleeves and working along with them as a kind of servant almost, you,
yes,
know.
Yes.
Rather say, but not being a political agitator.
No, no. That's right.
So that took me up to Christmas.
Yes.
That was 4 months.
Yes.
At which time I think I was probably on probation, because I think I seem to remember an interview with Miss Roxburgh.
On probation. That's
probationary, right. Probationary status as to whether I was going to make it into the almoner's training.
Gosh, I see.
Yeah, I mean, I had been accepted for this, but I think, I'm pretty sure, because that, you know, obviously that I was, had no experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it was very obvious that they'd want to have reports on you, and I presume Miss Bolton and Miss Barton sent jolly little reports to the Institute of Almoners, who were responsible for my training and had placed me there, but as I say, in a sense, on trial.
Yes.
And then I went off to Thomas's.
Uh-huh, yes. But was that supervised practice as well? Or?
We didn't really have you know, supervision as we know it now is really didn't exist in medical social work training. I suppose it had begun in PSW training, which I think had got going about 1926, hadn't it?
A bit later than that.
On the other hand, we were... It was the kind of supervision an apprentice had, in a way. I mean, it didn't mean that you didn't get discussion about your cases, but the kind of... it was very different, in a way. Mm. I suppose perhaps less different than some of it is now, but there were no sort of, oh, you must have a formal hour and a half session, and so on. It just trickled along.
Yes, yes. And what was it, I mean, was that the first time you'd actually stepped foot inside a hospital when you went there? Or had...
As a worker, yes. I must have stepped into a hospital before somehow. I hadn't been a patient, certainly. You didn't give me too many shocks in any case.
Because of your background?
I think because of my background and so on. I mean, there were a lot of new things and customs about it, which... I was unaware of, because actual fact, you know, whatever I'd picked up was really from either a nursing or a medical student tradition, rather than a social work student tradition.
Was it? I mean, it's an organisation. It's sort of much bigger than, say, working in the Hogan office, even though that was a large
CRC. Yes, it was a big, there were nearly 20 medical social workers, almoners at Thomas's.
20?
Yes, well, you see, it was one of the hospitals which the almoners were also responsible for assessment.
Yes.
If you weren't belonging to the HSA or the HSF or calendars, cables, or whatever was the particular, you see, most people, that shows how long ago it is, doesn't it? I should say more than 50% of your patients, and certainly the ones in more regular employment, paid into a thing called the Hospital Savings Association, or the Hospital Sanity Fund. Or there were certain firms which ran their own hospital club, as it were. And when they were in benefit for that, it paid for hospital treatment.
Yes.
And they produced little green or yellow or certificates from the group secretary of the group they paid into. And provided they produced that, they were... Sometimes were well armed and produced it straight away, some didn't. They were covered for quite a lot of hospital treatment, practically all their outpatient treatment. Otherwise you were exposed to extract some money from them. Now see, if at that time of a era you'd gone to King's College Hospital, they had developed a different system. If you didn't produce your voucher or the promise of it, you put something in a box, you know, you kind of bought a ticket, and so the medical social workers there didn't have any responsibility for assessment. And you ought really to go and see one of the people who was brought up in the King's tradition, because it was very different. And there were then three groups of training hospitals in London for medical students. There was Thomas's.
Yes.
King, and then King's was number two, and then there was one called the Group, which was Brompton, Great Ormond Street, Royal Free, I think, and St Mary's, and you whistled around between them, whereas when you went to Thomas's, you whistled around the departments.
So you say whistled around, you mean you moved between
hospital,
each of the hospitals?
Yeah, if it were 20 almoners, and you moved about once a month.
I see.
Which again, you know, was rarely, presumably, meant there was no possibility of learning casework.
Yes.
all on a long-term basis. But then hospital, social work, you know, a fair proportion of it is short-term work.
Yes. Yes.
But you moved round, you say, every month.
Yes.
And then you had to do 2 months out in what was called your provincial. And I went up to Liverpool in July, August, I think it was, to David Lewis Hospital, Liverpool, for 2 months. Was it, or was it June, July, any summer, you know,
yes,
in the summer.
And when you moved around like that, were you allotted to different, working in different wards?
Well, we were allotted to different, you were allotted to a medical social worker.
Yes.
Who actually worked in a unit or a ward.
Yes.
I started off with a very nice young social worker called Miss Tew in the eye department.
Yes.
And that was the eye, she covered the eye ward and eye ophthalmic outpatients.
Yes.
Then I moved to what was known as the Northcote Trust. They'd had a sort of foundation, special money to, and there were about 4 or 5 medical social workers all working on the inpatient wards. And I went to a very dear lady called Miss Deacon. And really what happened was you sometimes were lucky to have a desk of your own. If not, you sat more or less beside your supervisor. And if you had a desk, it was a little desk of your own, you'd start seeing patients if they came in, some of them.
Yes.
You'd both be working in the same room. She would often, of course, listen in to her interviews, and this is something very different. Though we're coming back to it, you see, a bit. You do read now, don't you, of people who are saying that we're the only profession who doesn't give its students the benefit of hearing other people's skills in practice.
Yes.
But you did quite a lot then. And it was a very sort of friendly relationship, really. You know, you'd be sitting beside them, slightly back, told not to make yourself obvious. To look at a bit of paper so you didn't stare at the client, but you could take a good quiet look. Yes, you better take a look at them, even though you weren't trying to be. I think quite an attempt for you not to intervene in the relationship and yet observe it. And then as they would go out, you know, having decided perhaps, you know, maybe even planning a convalescence or something like that, or a summer holiday for a poorly kid, they'd turn to you and say, we might like to read that case paper. She's been in, I've known her 2 or 3 years, or she's quite new. And quite a rich amount of social detail, person and assessment of personality would come through just in conversation to you.
Yes. Yes.
Never written down, very little written down on the case record, really. But these were, some of them, very good, experienced people.
Yes.
And I think we got an enormous lot like that, really, out of it.
Yes. Being sophisticated, but it all being held in the head and just transmitted.
Yes, it was just transmitted by word, you know, and perhaps if you had done the interview, they'd listened in, they would, you know, comment on it to you. The good ones were very gentle with you, I think. Quite firm, but very gentle.
Yes.
There were 4, you might say, holy horrors. There's names I won't mention, because I think they were probably very able social workers.
Yes.
But they scared the wits out of their students.
Yes.
And really, we used to all go over to lunch. We used to buy rolls and cheese and things. And Mr. Pentecost, who had a little corner shop just opposite Thomas's. I think it's probably bombed down now. And then we go off to Royal Street, which was a very early maternity and child welfare centre, which was really run by the hospital before, you know, in many ways they've got going with the state as much. Mm-hmm. And we'd there make ourselves tea and eat our sandwiches and discuss like students did. You do, you know, what had gone on. So I think maybe some of these stories got a little bit magnified. About, you know, these four dragons, as it were. And of course, a lot of our conversation used to be a guessing competition as to where your next move would be, because you probably wouldn't be told till your third week or fourth week who you would go on to, so you sort of watched the chessboard slightly.
You were told, you were consulted about that.
You were told. Yeah. Quite certainly you were told. And, well, but I mean, I don't think any of us thought of saying I won't.
Yes. And you used to speculate as to where you might be going. And
well, yes, I mean, you knew you'd been in ophthalmics and Northcote Trust and, say, the tuberculosis unit, you know, and you'd got several more to do. You hadn't done casualty or orthopedics or skins and mental health. And you hadn't done maternity, so you know, gradually as you moved round, you got nearer and nearer the fact that the only other place you could be sent to was there.
Yes, yes. Did you, each supervisor talk to you something about the conditions that the people on the wards were suffering from? That you,
oh yes, so you, yes, you had, yes, you got a lot of, you know, both about their medical conditions, you were out and very openly allowed to see them for a long time. And you used to be taken on the ward. You sent up later on the wards on your own, but to them you used to be go round with, you know, and go and talk to sister with your arm and yes, you got a lot of good medical information larded with a great deal of the social implications of it.
Yes.
From this.
Yes.
And you were expected to have a medical dictionary to look where things up. Well, another thing I forgot to tell you, before you actual fact got accepted, I think even before you went to your COS, all prospective almoner students had to spend 2 days in hospitals sitting beside and up as a kind of, for them to see what it was like and the Institute to see what you were like. And I'd done my 2 days at pharmacist too. So, but was really quite carefully chosen.
Yes, I was thinking it's quite a rigorous.
It was a very rigorous. It was a really a very, I mean, a very rigorous training. You might have said some of the things which we now teach students were not taught.
Yes.
But you were watched over like a hawk.
Yes.
If necessary. And a lot of the sort of Thomas's traditions slightly rubbed off us.
Yes.
Like, frankly, you weren't supposed to run in the corridors. There were various camps about whether you should have your overall buttoned up. We all wore grey overalls, rather than like barrage balloons.
Yes.
And you'd find some, if it was army you were working with, say, Miss So-and-so, you ought to keep your overall buttoned up. I think all students do. Of course, we can't enforce it because Miss Deacon never buttons hers up.
Yes.
One of the senior ones always went around without it being buttoned up. And things like this.
Yes. Yes. Something floated into my mind just then. I wanted to follow up from that. Yes, can I just come back to something else you said right earlier on when we began? You were talking about, you know, your choice of social work, and you sort of mentioned in passing looking for the problem of finding, you know, a profession which was open to women. You didn't say something about that. And I went,
No, I didn't, because you've been thought, I don't think I did, I thought reading there a bit, because one of the things when I started looking around for a profession, now what I was saying was that men, you know, you only, but then after all, Oxford was, classical education at Oxford was a very male preserve, and there were about 30 of men to about 5 women, I think, in my year, doing classics. No, when I decided that archaeology was not for me, I then started thinking that I didn't want to do a profession like the civil service, where, in a sense, I wouldn't be exactly aping a man, but I would. I think I then arrived at something that, you know, one needed to use one's feminine qualities in.
Yes, yes.
To be a woman in, and to be important as a woman, perhaps.
Yes, yes.
And this perhaps led me into social work, which was then, of course, much more only a woman's profession. I mean, except for, well, childcare hadn't begun, and probation had a fair amount of men in, but the vast majority were women. And
but in probation at that time?
No, probation was the one that always had more men in it.
Yes, but the rest
made, psychiatric social work, and, well, there was only psychiatric social work, medical social work, and family case work from the COS,
yeah.
And the very few professionally based family casework agencies in the provinces.
Yes,
yeah,
PSS in Liverpool.
Yes, and I think there was one up in Glasgow, Edinburgh, or something like that. And they could have been counted on your fingers of one hand,
yes,
probably.
I see, yes. So it wasn't, the fact that you're going into social work wasn't a reflection of the unequal position of women at that time?
I don't think so. I don't think... one, how far, well, I'm sure one was conscious of it, but it's rather as enormous. I mean, there was somebody, one of the lecturers in Oxford, who lectured on Aristophanes, who wouldn't let women do Aristophanes' comedies, who wouldn't let women come into his lecture room.
Sorry, but it,
he was lecturing, I've forgotten who he was, but he lectured on Aristophanes' comedies.
Yes.
And of course they are fairly crude sometimes, and he wouldn't let women into his lectures. On the other hand, I went, as I was reading on a mods, on a classical mods, I went, most of the lectures were in the men's colleges, and I suppose I spent a vast amount of time sitting around college dining.